Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Wax Cast. This is episode 22, second episode of the new year. And today I'm joined by a good friend of mine and a political conservative commentator and contributor to Metropolitan Magazine, Jaden Horan. Jaden, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, Gavin.
So I wanted to bring you on for this special episode as we have the runoff elections in Georgia. The results are coming in as we speak. I want to go through them. You've been involved in politics in a few different states, and you kind of know the lay of the land. I think you're from south of the Mason-Dixon line. I'm not exactly sure where you're from, but, you know, close enough for our purposes here in New York. What do you think is going to go on in Georgia? Do you have any predictions? Obviously, you know, I'm giving you an easier layup here since we have some results coming in. Do you think we're going to have a good night tonight, us being Republicans, or you think we're going to be looking at another catastrophic loss for our party and movement?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a catastrophic loss, but I don't think it's going to be a good night for Republicans. I think, you know, we're looking at something really unique here. It is the actual chance for the Republican Party to kind of jettison the establishment that has controlled it since the Reagan era. And I think the only way that really is done is if, unfortunately, Mitch McConnell loses the leader position in the Senate. So I do believe, you know, quite a few Republicans in Georgia are making a strategic decision. Do they want more of the Republican Party of old, or do they want to sit this out and allow the Democratic trifecta and then new Republicans, new blood to come surging in 2 years to regain control? And so I think what we're seeing, and if you look at some of the results, there's definitely in almost every county and every precinct that is reported a downtick in turnout in comparison from the general to the Senate, both on both sides, of course. But that means that without Trump at the top of the ticket, Republicans are sitting out. We have to ask ourselves why that would be. We need those people to turn out because the Democratic machine that exists in Georgia is in full gear. And we know that early voting has broken records. Republicans in general don't participate in early voting. And we know that the lines that are exceedingly long right now in Georgia are in urban areas, which means that they are motivated because they sense blood in the water, right? Like, this is all that's standing between them and complete control of this country. And so Democrats are motivated. What is the Republican motivation? To prevent Democratic control? Okay, that'll get your typical Republican out. But what's going to get a Trump supporter for the first time ever pulled for a Republican to come out?
Right.
If Trump's not elected, what's going to get them to come out? Fear of Democrats? No, they probably were Democrats, or they are in general okay with the idea of Democrats, not, of course, these progressive socialist Democrats.
They're not institutional Republicans. They're not institutional Republicans. Those are the guys, you know, they voted, or guys and women who voted for Obama and then flipped to Trump. And they're a huge constituency that the establishment of the Republican Party has ignored. They're a constituency we probably could have grown in 2020. I'm not saying the results are obviously accurate, but it's certainly a demographic that exists out there that needs to be tapped more, particularly in the Rust Belt. My only pushback to you, and obviously I understand your sentiments, and many people have expressed the same sentiments about burning down, you know, the McConnell faction and the establishment faction. It's obviously a dangerous gamble because, you know, the repercussions of losing the Senate will be, you know, extreme. Obviously, you have people like Manchin, and, you know, there may be other things to, you know, there are some moderate Dems still, maybe a Sinema or whoever, who maybe want to pivot as a maverick now that they have more control, being, you know, these kind of on the fence voters. But at the same time, maybe to be devil's advocate here, the people that would be staying home for the exact reasons you specified, there is another contingent of maybe former Republicans, the sort of suburbanite country club Republicans, who may feel more inclined to come out and vote in this race than they did in, say, the presidential. Do you think that'll have a counterbalance and change anything at all? Or you still think we're going to be seeing a deficit in terms of, you know, maybe the Republicans turning out to, you know, spite the McConnells of the world?
I mean, isn't that the irony, though? You know, those same Republicans that cost President Trump Georgia and basically re-election are now the Republicans we think they're going to turn out for Purdue and Loeffler. Yeah, they probably will because they are traditional Republicans. But at the end of the day, people will sit at home if the first and only time they've ever participated in our elections was to pull for President Trump. They're just not going to come out. And the numbers show that. There is a precipitous drop off of enthusiasm and therefore turnout.
No. We saw it in 2018. We saw in the 2018 midterms. It was a bloodbath because Trump was not at the top of the ticket. Trump was at the top of the ticket in 2020. Down ballot was fantastic. Obviously, the rhinos and the – that's the problem, though, with everything you're saying, is because the establishment and the rhinos are always going to spin it, obviously, to suit their narrative. So in the case in point with the 2020 election, their response was, oh, well, we did better down ballot because people like the Republican message, but they don't like Trump's message. And they're going to spin – and Trump said it at the rally. They're going to spin no matter what happens tonight. If Trump, if they win, it's in spite of Trump. And if they lose, it's because of Trump. He can't win. It's a lose-lose for him, really.
Yeah. And look, all those narratives are horseshit because at the end of the day, Washington Post did a study, an in-depth study that showed that Trump expanded the party in places that were so unexpected and mm-hmm. and that no Republican has been competitive in since the 1920s that they really don't know what to make of it. I mean, their conclusion to the article was they don't know the implications when hmm. when a Republican is pushing turnout up by 500,000 votes in Los Angeles County, that means something. If yeah. you are able to get that many more votes, because let's look at the demographics of Los Angeles County. All right. It is a majority minority county.
Yep.
Which means you are getting votes from minorities. And if yep. that were to happen across the country, then the future demographic Democratic majority is a mirage.
It
so,
is.
You know,
it's chipping away at their house of cards because they have to maintain this crazy supermajority in terms of the math to yep. sustain their coalition. And yep. I understood Trump's strategy in the general. A lot of people were criticizing it because they said maybe he was taking for granted his white working class base. And there are some truths to that. He should have still catered to his core base. But what they were doing was if they could just chip away at the margins at this working class minority voting block that has really propped up the Democrat machine, if they could chip away at that at the margins, you can see a situation like the Rio Grande Valley where all these working class Hispanics trended Republican, you know, to an insane level. I mean, I think it was in New York, one of the biggest counties that shifted was the Bronx. Obviously, you're moving from a very low number to just a slightly better number, but still the percentage growth in a place like the Bronx, I mean, is impressive. And that's what you're talking about, these counties.
Look, if Donald Trump, and, you know, I think looking at that Washington Post report, looking at what happens with the results tonight. So back to your point about them spinning whether tonight our Senate candidates win or lose. Here's the thing. Trump is now on the ballot and it actually has nothing to do with him. What this has to do with is whether or not traditional Republicans are willing to come out to save the party. And if they aren't. If the Republicans lose control of the Senate, what that tells me is that Trump is a viable 2024 candidate. What that tells me is that the new coalition that Trump has built is a coalition that the party needs to embrace. Now, if these voters come out and they save the party, fine. Then Mitch McConnell keeps the gavel and we limp on. But that means that there's going to be a real war because there's going to be control between the McConnellites and, you know, those that are supporting
Trumpians.
Exactly. And the end result of that is going to be, unfortunately, a very weak 2024 candidate if it's not the president.
And I have to make another historical analysis here because you're kind of, you know, touching on it a bit. I mean, when we had a similar situation, a similar divide in the party, say in the 60s between the Rockefellers and the emergent conservative movement under Goldwater and then eventually under Reagan, at least the Rockefeller wing, Rockefeller himself endorsed Goldwater and they endorsed their opponents and they still got in line with the party and they advanced the cause. I will give them credit. It seems the Never Trumpers today, the moderate faction, if you can even call them that today, you know, they pride themselves in being the mature ones and being the ones who are going to uphold the party and protect the party. But they're the ones who have played the most dirty. They're the ones who have put the most knives in more fellow Republicans' backs. And they're the ones who are really spiting not just our party, but really our republic, just for their own petty egos. Everything that they project onto Trump and his movement is really what they themselves are guilty of.
Isn't that the irony? The good old boys that control the party, the same good old boys that, you know, didn't want minorities and didn't want women to participate in the party because they wanted to keep it in, you know, the way that they could control, because it's all about control, are the same ones that didn't want someone like Donald Trump, who was a billionaire, who they couldn't buy, who they couldn't manipulate, who was unafraid to hire liberals, to hire black people, to hire minorities, to hire women in positions of influence and listen to them more than a bunch of old white guys who've been around for 80 years doing the same thing and failing at it. You know, that is the irony. Because when we look at it, it's about class, it's about race, it's about gender. It's all the things that we actually accuse, that we as Republicans are accused of, but it really is only a tiny subset of people, because it is all about power. It is not about any of the things the left tries to ascribe, but it's about power.
But I do think it's a classist thing. And I think, you know, that could really, you know, describe the biggest divide in this party, because you have this Chamber of Commerce, you know, a pro-business kind of elitist wing of the party that are actually a small fraction of it, that have really dominated the Republican Party, its institutions, and have always been part of the, you know, the DC bureaucracy, so to speak. And then you have this mass kind of growing working class, non-college educated, blue collar base that is despised and looked down upon by, say, the, you know, the Kemps of the world, or the Raffensperger's, or however the hell you pronounce his name, and all these other, you know, uppity Republican establishment types. It really is a class intra-party class struggle, if you look at it. I mean, I don't want to go too much into Marxist dialectics here, but it kind of feels that way.
Well, that's what it is, because at the end of the day, the Republican Party was the party of the elites, the business class. And that's what it was from the Civil War roughly until, you know, the 1970s. And suddenly in the 1970s, after the Great Stagnation and the free market orthodoxy won in the party, we started winning converts, because we demonstrated that, you know, the controlled command control economy that the Democrats advocated for, that the Keynesians wanted, destroyed wealth, prevented upward mobility. And all of a sudden, all of these other people began to believe the tenets and principles of the Republican Party, and it expanded. It expanded beyond the elites and the college educated to normal, average, everyday Americans. But the elites never changed out of the power structures, and they really, other than wanting people to show up for votes, don't want the rabble to participate in the election process, or actually in the party's power.
Look,
the Mitch McConnells of the world look at, you know, the grassroots the same way that Hillary Clinton looked at Trump supporters, as deplorables. Yeah. They absolutely look at what happened with the Tea Party. Okay, the Tea Party reinvigorated the conservative movement and gave it an idea, which was that taxes in general, even if they serve a good purpose, are total and utter shit, because all the government's going to do with that money is use it like a bank does, and take each dollar extra in taxes and borrow 10 times that dollar. So you end up owing way more, 100 times more. And it said, no, enough. We don't want that. And Republicans, you're complicit. And what did the party do? They co-opted it. They co-opted it. They killed it.
They did. And it became milquetoast, and it became just another slogan, and it didn't really have any substance or meaning behind it. But could you blame Trump to a degree for not really enacting the sort of institutional change that was necessary when he ascended into the White House in 2016? Because had he gone into the RNC and really cleaned house and really installed loyalists, and that goes for his administration too. I'm just talking on the party side here, because it actually gets less discussion than I think the administration. A lot of people talk about administration staffing, but the RNC is also just as critical, and there's a race coming up. I mean, he has way more, you could even argue, just because of his persona and his cult of personality and the way he can drive people in numbers, he could have had way more control over the RNC than he did. And he barely exercised it. And they sort of just accepted him, but they, in many, many respects, it was business as usual. And the second the chips were down for him, as we've seen in 2020, they already dug the knife in his back. They were ready to move on. They were ready to, you know, forget about him and go back to business as usual. I mean, do you think that's going to happen? Do you think that he made some failings? Two questions in one here.
Look, hindsight is 2021, right? It is 2021, because some of us back then were screaming at the top of our lungs, trying to figure out why the president was so naive in believing that he could hire non-loyalists in his White House, let alone allow an RNC infrastructure and a Speaker of the House that was categorically against him, that was working from day one to undermine him, and leave them in their positions.
Yep. He has this mentality that
Hillary knew that she needed, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And the moment she was useless, she replaced her with Donna Brazile. She exercised power in totality over her party, utter and complete control. Because if you don't, and there are rebellions, or there is not support below the surface for all of the staffer level, you will never achieve your agenda. This is politics 101. And Trump failed at that because he didn't do politics. He ran a company where the CEO could just say, you know what? You're doing a shit job. Fire that person, fire that person, fire that person. Let's move on. Right. Not where you have to and you don't know what whole organizations are doing and the power structures involved.
And it's hard to quantify.
And exactly. And you have to trust and defer to their expertise because it's not your organization that you control. It's one that you are being hired to control.
Well, that's why his second term would have been, or could still be, I'm not saying it's over, but it could be so critical because it would have allowed him, one, to shake off all that nonsense that was holding him back in the first term, including Russiagate, the impeachment, all that, the coup d'etat attempts against him from the deep state. And two, he would have built up sufficient institutional knowledge. He would have built up a better team around him of loyalists. The staffing was getting better. They were starting to put things in the right direction. So for all the great successes he had in his first term, which really cannot be understated how much he did in a single term as a Republican, especially with 2 years, he didn't even have united government. The second term would have been so critical, so pivotal, and would have just really paved the way for tons in terms of effectuating policy. That's why it's just so crushing to morale of people like me and others who hold, you know, who are supporters of Donald Trump, to see that this election was stolen from him and we're losing out on all that precious opportunity that was waiting for us. And it just really goes to show that the snakes, the utter snakes and weasels and phonies like the Paul Ryans of the world and even the Mitch McConnells, they really ruined the first 2 years of this administration. We had united government and we barely did anything. I mean, we did things, but you know, when we had united government, we could have passed so many more bills. We could have passed so much more legislation. We could have effectuated so much more in terms of policy. Instead, you know, we got the tax cuts, you know, we barely got rid of the individual mandate. I mean, we didn't really, it wasn't all there. I mean, am I wrong in my pessimism and looking back on it?
No, not at all. It was the most squandered opportunity in recent American history. Democrats would never squander their opportunity.
Yep, exactly.
They would never squander their opportunity.
Because they're ruthless.
They are ruthless. They know how to execute power in such a way that when they wield it, that they do it with lethality.
Yep.
Republicans don't know how to fight. And they don't know how to govern because they're unaccustomed to dealing with real people and they're unaccustomed to having to make decisions and stand by it with scrutiny.
Because they love being the opposition. They love being the token opposition where they could just say what they need to say, but never have to actually effectuate it.
Look, before Newt Gingrich, the House Republicans weren't in power for 40 years and they got wildly comfortable with that. When he came in, you know, he still vilified to a point, I suppose, with some, you know, establishmentarians. But when he first took over as Speaker of the House, I mean, they hated him within the Republican Party because he dared to challenge the orthodoxy. Never mind that he gave them the largest majority in, you know, 60 years. That wasn't great. It was the fact that he challenged the orthodoxy and they vilified him. And, you know, scandal followed him very quickly from his own party, releasing, you know, stuff about affairs and divorces and everything else. So how is that any different than Trump? He brings Republicans the first victory in the Midwest in states that, you know, Poppy Bush won. And lo and behold, the Bush people come out rather than be like, hey, this is great. You know, we're once again competitive in our old places. It's we got to take this guy down.
Right. Because they
don't, of the aisle.
They just want their own caucus and their own faction within the party to be powerful. They could care. That's why I honestly don't think many of them, maybe McConnell. McConnell may care because of his ego and he wants to still be, you know, the majority leader. But I do think there is a subset of the Republican establishment that really doesn't even care if we keep or hold the Senate because they just want dominance within their own party structure. They don't really care about the inter-party struggle between the Democrats and Republicans. For them, that's all just show. They just want, you know, an iron grip over their party. And if they gain a majority here and there, great. You know, they'll figure out something to do with it. They'll grandstand better. But they don't really want to govern, or they don't really care to govern. And you know, as long as they maintain their internal caucus's power, they're fine with whatever happens. I mean, is it crazy to suggest that? Because a lot of people are again saying that's true for the Trump wing. But I do think there's obviously some intellectual divisions, and some of it's warranted, some of it's interesting. But I do think the majority of the Trump base does want to keep the Senate. I do think there's a lot of people who are very aggrieved and upset, and that's one thing. But I do think philosophically and fundamentally they do care about, you know, maintaining control more so than I think the establishment.
Well, I think this is where, you know, individuals' own Machiavellian instincts play to our party's favor. You know, there is no one that compares to Mitch McConnell. Nancy Pelosi does not, you know, Harry Reid does not, but he's on our team.
Right.
And what that means is that we win. So, you know, if the Senate is held, Mitch is not going to roll over. So Republicans, Trumpians, can take that as solace, you know, if the Senate is kept. Because, you know, as many criticisms, and there are many that I have, and as much skepticism I have about what Mitch McConnell's true intents are, how he exercises and what he does and the things he sticks to, you know, we can rely on. And I think, you know, he is in his own wing, which I think is the Mitch McConnell wing. I don't think anyone really occupies it. I think different senators are in transient about whether or not they align with the leader or not. I don't think it's more to an ideology. I think it's more to power. And
you told me once, you gave me a good summary of McConnell. You said, really, he just cares about his little kingdom. He just cares about the Senate, what goes on in the Senate. He doesn't give a damn about the House. He doesn't give a damn about the presidency. He doesn't care about down ballots. He doesn't care about state legislatures. All he thinks, lives, and breathes is the Senate. And that may be good in certain circumstances, if he could be, you know, ideologically in line and more loyal. But in the case we're facing now, his kind of short-sightedness and his sort of, you know, just sort of what's the term? Provincial outlook, I guess you can say, or, you know, just his own little fiefdom, that really sets us back as a party and a movement.
I mean, I think that's exactly what, you know, I opened with. You know, if the party wants to move past the establishment of old, the only way we do that is lose tonight. And I'm not saying we ought to lose tonight or that we should lose tonight or that
it'll be an accelerationist thing, though.
Exactly. It is not a preferred outcome. I think, you know, we have to put every brake on the progressives that are going to take over the Democratic Party under Biden because he's asleep at the wheel. But at the same time, the faster we move on making the GOP a modern party and build in all the places that Trump has built us and take on a message that resonates with real people and actually sees the consequences of these, you know, 30 years of open borders and 30 years of trade without consequences, right? Because I'm a free trader. But at the same time, if there are negative consequences and negative externalities, what's missed in all the messaging is what's missed in the politician saying, oh, free trade, is that every single one of those things, if you study Friedman or anyone else, they said, no, those dislocations are almost worse than the regulation that prevented the dislocation. That if you don't plan for the dislocation, then you will destroy people's lives and aggregate wealth and it will not come back.
And the economists that you're citing are not politicians. I mean, you know, had you, you know, you take their economic analysis and you also add a political layer to it to be like, oh, what are the ramifications for this politically? No Republican ever should have been supporting free trade, or at least not to the degree it did. Certainly not multilateral free trade agreements like NAFTA.
Certainly not free trade agreements that
manage trade,
that deport your entire manufacturing base and entire middle class to countries in which are likely to be geopolitical rivals and one day use that same manufacturing base you exported to build a war machine to ultimately fight you. I mean, talk about a myopic, short-sighted, idiotic vision of using the markets
That's the Republican Party.
To build short-term wealth in the United States. Yeah, no, that exactly is.
It's all short-term thinking. The Dems are planning 30 years in ahead and like this Fabian type of socialist approach.
They're planning a century. I mean, that's what they're looking for.
Yeah, a century. It's like a century. Yeah. They're planning, you know, slow takeovers of institutions, slow demographic changes or radical changes, economic, cultural. I mean, they're looking at this in every different vertical outside of the realm of politics. And they're thinking, like you said, 100 years ahead. And not only do they play the long game, but they also play the short game very ruthlessly and viciously, and they fight. So they just always run circles around us no matter what. And it's just repeated time and time again until people like Trump stepped in and showed people how to fight. I think he had some flaws and he had some bad advisors around him who may have neutered his ability to fight as much as he probably his natural inclinations would have allowed. But we certainly saw the results. I mean, like you mentioned with breaking the blue wall and all these places. I mean, I do want to ask you, I mean, talking about this changing electoral map, I mean, some things are good, some things are better. I mean, do you think Georgia is going to turn into the next Virginia?
You know, unlike North Carolina, Georgia actually has the capacity to turn into the next Virginia or Colorado because of the dominance, and actually Arizona too, the dominance of one major metropolitan area. There is a real danger. And I would say the better analogy actually is the next Illinois. Because when you have utter and complete and total dominance by one very, very, very left-leaning city and its suburbs, then you have no chance once they seize the party apparatus and the government apparatus in the state of ever flipping back. So
I think North Carolina doesn't have that centralization of urbanity, which is interesting. And it's funny because North Carolina legitimately flipped for Obama in 08, but now it trended to the right of Georgia. So did Florida. Yep. And even Florida's not as concentrated because they have a ton of big cities, Tampa, Miami, et cetera. Georgia never trended left.
That's why it took California 45 years to go from right to left.
And that was a lot of external immigration.
It was, but because it had a decentralized metropolitan
structure.
Structure and physical geography. With multiple cities, you have larger suburbs in between, you have competing interests. I mean, look, still Northern California to Southern California and control of that state and the interests they have and the needs they have, the water issues in Southern California are fought against the environmentalism of the North. Even though it's now all on the left, that's still their fight. Look, North Carolina has the same thing. That's why Pennsylvania is able to be a continually purplish, now leaning red state, because it doesn't have one big city. It has two, with enough smaller metros in between to make up the difference.
Well, this also goes back to
Georgia is a real danger. Georgia and Arizona are real dangers. And Republicans need to wake up because, you know, the suburbs are not, and suburban voters are not reflexively Republican.
And not suburban white women, I'll tell you that much.
And no, but what they are is they are reflexively good governance. And Republicans have not demonstrated in those states and definitely not demonstrated on the national level that we know how to govern. People in the
suburbs. That's why we have to shift out maybe some of the libertarian approaches, which is just, you know, approaching everything like no government. You should approach it as, well, we're going to have some government, but it's going to be managed better. We're going to cut where we can, but the ones we have are definitely going to be managed better. I mean, that's a better message. I agree. For a suburban, you know, regional area, which I'm not saying has to be the approach universally, but, you know, we have state by state, we have state parties that should, depending on the state in question, really heighten that. And I'm all for big tents. I'm all for, you know, a more moderate Republican in places outside of a traditional Republican state, you know, running to the left on some issues or maybe just running to the center. Because it'll appeal to that voting bloc, as long as they don't get in national politics. But I also wanted to mention on a legalistic thing, these states, because you bring up a really interesting point with the division in terms of the geography and the spread of the population in the metropolitan regions. You know, prior to, I believe, the 60s, where they started really enacting all that liberal SCOTUS decisions in terms of one man, one vote, many states used to have federal systems at the state level.
At the state level,
in the sense that each county was always guaranteed, say, a vote in their upper chamber, or their districts were not necessarily always based on population, that they were based on just fixed locations, sort of like how the U.S. Senate was. Even in a place like New York City, they had the Board of Estimate here, and I think this was a SCOTUS, decision in like the late 80s or something. They had to change the New York City charter that a county like or a borough like Staten Island had an equal vote on this Board of Estimate. So it gave some, you know, it gave some political power, and it weighted it a bit towards rural areas, towards just not areas that are just necessarily concentrations of people and population. They got rid of those systems. So a ton of state legislatures had to change. A ton of states had to redistrict how they did their state, you know, how they drew their state lines, et cetera. And that really had a massive negative impact. And I don't think a lot of conservatives talk about it. And I also think it was just a stupid decision from SCOTUS and a long line of stupid decisions, because the Constitution basically says, you know, states are required to have Republican forms of government. Well, what is a Republican form of government? Our United States Constitution. What does our United States Constitution have? It has a Senate where it has a body that does not have necessarily – it has equal representation regardless of population size. And many states had replicated that at the state level. And it was a good thing. Once that got rid of it, you created a situation for one-party control in a place like Illinois, in a place like New York. And that's destroyed those states, one-party rule.
Well, not only one party rule, but also one type of demographic rule.
Yeah.
You know, the whole purpose of the SCOTUS decision on one man or one person, one vote had to do with the fact of alleviating and ameliorating, you know, essentially ingrained or actual back then structural racism, where, you know, rural voters, especially in the South, were likely Black. Were outweighed, ironically, by urban whites. And, you know, the progressives came along and you know, many Republicans, even, you know, traditional conservative Republicans, could see the logic in that, because there were real structurally created systems that were racist. But guess what? Where one issue is solved, another one becomes magnified. And what that is that what that did, though, was balance interests between urban and rural areas within states, and prevented states from being overly dominated by one type of human being, that human being being a city urban dweller who has a particular set of interests. Let's look at California, where the farmers, many of them are immigrants. Many of them are now Mexican immigrants, but they were Scandinavian immigrants that live in the Central Valley, are habitually and regularly starved of water for the very farms that California is famous for growing the nation's food and fruit and grains and nuts, by the people that live in San Francisco and Southern California that either pump their water out down to Southern California in the case of LA, or prohibit it in the case of San Francisco, because they control the state government, because right. California doesn't really have real representation for its rural voters, irrespective of their party. They're reflected that they vote Republican now, but they didn't used to. They didn't, right, exactly. Right? Like the suburban and areas were exactly, they were the Republicans. Those were agrarian Democrats, like what Iowa used to be.
Right.
And lo and behold, the Republican Party, you know, woke up to the idea that, you know, some of the values that people in rural areas have are more in line with us. And there was this, you know, flipping convergence. But if we take the party label off these people, we have people who are literally denied basis on the basis of where they live from right. the rights that they should have by people who live in a larger mass in another part of the state.
Right.
That's what we have as a result.
And our founders knew this. Our founders knew this.
Rule.
Yeah. And our founders knew this, and they made provisions for it in our federal constitution. And for many years, it was replicated at the state level. And we've removed that. And that's been a kind of hidden thing that isn't talked about a lot. That's really destroyed a lot of state level governments. But I want to go back to the electoral math, the electoral map. We see these states that have been traditional Republican strongholds, whether it's Arizona and Georgia, they're obviously trending blue. They have been trending blue. This was something maybe you could even date to before Trump. If anything, Trump helped slow that down a bit in 16 and helped gain ground in other areas that we needed to really accelerate in, namely the Rust Belt. some people will say, okay, look, it's not that big of a deal. We'll lose Arizona. We'll lose Georgia. But maybe another cycle, you know, a PA will become way more competitive. A Michigan will become way more competitive. Wisconsin will fall into our column. I mean, Ohio already is. I mean, Ohio used to be the great bellwether state. It was as purple as can be. Republican, it's a Republican state now. Even Florida, you could argue, is a Republican state now. And I think those two, and Iowa, I think those have been solidified within our column. But you're also seeing even trends in Nevada. Nevada's went from red to blue. Now it seems to be trending back to red. So there are some positive developments. Do you think that's going to happen quick enough to prevent what everyone's sort of the doom and gloom is of 70 years of Democrat unified control, which is really what they want? They want to recreate the FDR years and on steroids, so to speak.
You know, what really needs to happen is the Republican Party needs to hold the line in the South and with their traditional suburban votes, and they need to continue to fight for the working men and women in the United States, irrespective of race. And that was the one thing that racist Donald Trump was able to do that non-racist Mitt Romney, non-racist John McCain, non-racist, well, I guess John McCain was racist because he dared to run against, Barack Obama. Then again, so was Mitt Romney. But, you know, I digress. You know, the mainstream media was, you know, quick to tag Donald Trump as racist, yet he expanded those margins and he spoke to those people in a way that no Republican has ever, and I hope no Republican will ever not do again.
Because establishment pandering has been disproven by Trump, because his whole message, I mean, he was doing some pandering, sure, you know, the silver plan or whatever you want to call it. But for the most part, his message, his appeal and what won him over those voters was his working class kind of machismo that, you know, appealed to, say, a working class Hispanic guy, a working class black guy that no Republican before him ever had. And if they double down on that strategy and they really build it out with some infrastructure and some real institutional backing, they could make serious inroads in these communities, many of which live in major cities, but they just want to pander and they just want to be weak and they just want to be, you know, tiptoe around because they don't want to be called racist, but that's never worked and it hasn't worked.
Pandering is only pandering if you pay lip service to what you're doing. Nancy Pelosi establishing the House Committee on Equality and bullshit, whatever, that's called pandering. Right. Like that's not for progressives. They're not really happy, but that's what they're going to say they got from Nancy Pelosi so that AOC and Ilhan Omar could vote for her and they got something. No, that's pandering. What Donald Trump did was he said, OK, black people are willing to talk to me. I like black people. I've always liked black people, contrary to what the media says. What do you need? Sit down. Tell me. Oh, shit. Republicans have never paid attention to you. OK, anything you're willing to do, I'm willing to consider. Throw me ideas. Oh, you think I should commute sentences of people who are innocent? That's a great idea. Let's do that. You think I should commute sentences of people who are overly prosecuted? Sure, that's a great idea. Let me do that. You think that I should do criminal justice reform? That's a great idea. Let me do that. You think that I should to look at and create a multi-point plan for the black community in America? Let me do that. That's not pandering. That's not lip service. That's actual action. Pandering would be, if it was 6 months before the election, sitting down with black community leaders, putting together some kind of nebulous plan, and then touting it, doing a bunch of ads, and then never talking shit about it ever again. That would be pandering.
Sounds like a lot of nonprofits.
The president didn't do that. So I have to say, look, at the end of the day, the party needs to understand that we have a moment. Should Donald Trump be the nominee in 2024? That's an open question. Could it be very much like what happened with Teddy Roosevelt, where he lost and then ran again because the party didn't have an idea of what it wanted for its future during this great kind of reinvention of, you know, the
realignment,
the environmental movement that was sweeping all the way even back then?
The progressives.
Yeah, but let's call them what they were. And they were about conservation and they were about the deconcentration of power and wealth. Right,
they were populists. They were meant. They were very much in line with what Trump's vision is now. And the funny thing is that there's a lot of liberal Republicans or progressive Republicans or moderates who hold up Teddy. And I'm thinking to myself, you were the same people had you lived during Teddy Roosevelt's time who would have been diametrically opposed to him in every way because he was busting the establishment. He was this kind of rogue figure that you couldn't control. Many parallels to Trump. And now you herald him because he was a little left on some issues. But back then, you would not have been an ally. You would have not have been a supporter. So it's just kind of hypocritical, and it kind of just, you know, shows that they're just disingenuous in many ways. But I do want to talk about what's going on in Georgia, but I'm actually going to pull up the New York Times map here so we can take a look at it. So right now in the Loeffler-Warnock race, 32% are in. 48 to 51. This is definitely tightened as I've been watching. And you can see here plus four, plus three. So things are starting to tighten. Only 32% of the votes are in. I think most of these are actually absentee or early voting. I don't think that most of this is day of voting. Whatever it counts for, it looks like New York Times is giving it 61% chance to Warnock here. And if you look at the map, I mean, I'm not an expert in Georgian geography, but it looks like, you know, a good chunk of Atlanta has already come in, and we're still missing huge swaths of rural Georgia. So if it's already this tight within, you know, 3 points, and most of Atlanta's already in, and what's left is rural areas, I mean, maybe this could turn out good for us. I mean, that's the Loeffler race. Purdue is even better, apparently. It's even closer in terms of the margins here. For some reason, they have more reporting. I don't know how that works. Can you translate this for me? I mean, what does this look like to you? I mean, I know there's a black belt down here in the southwest portion of the state. I don't see too many votes coming in yet, so that may be a detriment to the Republicans, the black belt. But, there you go again, just another dump. So it's back up to 10 and 11. Okay, I spoke too soon. Well, back to you, Jaden. What do you think?
So, you know, based on what I see, it looks like Republicans are underperforming, and in particular, I think for what now there is a differential, I think, of point, depending on what we're looking at, between 0.4 and 0.2 between what's happening with Purdue and what's happening with Senator Loeffler.
Loeffler or Loeffler?
Loeffler. Loeffler. I know. I always say Loeffler. You see the O.
I used to say Loeffler, but I heard Loeffler. I'm like, all right, no O, just take the O out. Jesus. All right, anyway.
Just take the O out. But what I find really interesting, though, is Republicans are underperforming, especially in the Atlanta suburbs. So far, what has come in, the gap between what Ossoff has gotten over Purdue is what he needs in order to secure a victory. And so the real question becomes, what is today's election day turnout? And will it be enough Republicans? And this is what I was saying, you know, earlier in this podcast, is that we have seen Republicans say, maybe I don't care about the institution of the party. Maybe I care about Donald Trump. And that's why I voted Republican in the first place. And I'm going to stay home because, to me, the Senate really doesn't matter.
The same Senate that wouldn't approve $2,000 direct aid to the American people, but would support, you know, billions and billions and billions in foreign aid. But they want to cry fiscal conservatism. I mean, that's the kind of hypocrisy and just utter out of touch mentality that has plagued Republicans, and it's plagued the reputation of the party. And frankly speaking, I mean, you know, I'm not saying Ossoff and Warnock are good candidates. They're not. It's actually a kind of shit field from both perspectives. But Loeffler, very robotic, you know, got caught with the insider trading thing in the height of COVID. Purdue, kind of the same thing. I mean, they've been decent votes in the Senate. I'm not saying their voting record has been horrible. I don't like how they, you know, voted against try to overturn the Trump veto. But for the most part, they're in the top 10 in terms of voting records, but they're just bad candidates. They're just bad candidates. I mean, when Purdue didn't want to debate, you know, Ossoff, I thought that was a stupid decision. I think you always should debate. So, I mean, you know, maybe this just comes down to just bad candidates, bad campaigning. You know, they were running all these campaign ads on socialism when everyone's out of work, everyone's unemployed, everyone's, you know, struggling to pay their bills, and they're running this campaign, you know, oh, we have to fight against socialism. And it's like, people aren't thinking about socialism. They're thinking about how they're going to support their families, and they're thinking about, why are transgenders being allowed into my daughter's, you know, dressing room? I mean, that's the kind of stuff that they're going to vote for. That's a lot more visceral than, you know, you want to talk about GDP numbers and economic stats. I mean, I just think there's just an out of touchness with the Republican consigned class and these candidates. Am I wrong? Am I crazy? Or is there some truth to this?
Well, where to begin? You know, both of Georgia's senators are perfectly fine, you know, run-of-the-mill Republicans.
Agreed.
And I have no problem with that. They can be counted on, you know, 9.9 times out of 10. You know, the NDAA is a piece of shit legislation. It's supported by the Uniparty. It's been passed every year, as they say, every year, every time for the last 60 years. Well, who was the president then, you know, and what was the Congress makeup of the country when it wasn't passed? Oh, okay. Well, I guess we have to go back to all the way to Eisenhower, who warned us that this military industrial complex would essentially take over the parties and it could, you know, ensure continued support of the war machine. And, right. And that's what we have, right? So yeah, I'm disappointed because both of these senators, you know, yielded to the military and all of the defense contractors and everyone else that would get their money. And, you know, implicit in that piece of legislation, if we can even call it that, of course, is all the foreign aid and everything else, along with the combined spending bill. And, you know, the things that our Congress always passes at the end of the year, which, you know, they used to be called omnibus bills, which were, you know, just the grab bag of bullshit. Now we called the NDA and the, I guess, the American stimulus or whatever we actually named it, which funded things that would typically be in the omnibus, right? Which would fund foreign aid and all these other programs. It just demonstrates once again that senators, even Republican senators, are missing the forest through the trees. How can you say that Americans don't deserve extra money of their money, which the government has taken in the form of taxation, right? So libertarians have that right. It is theft of people's money, and not give it back to them because they're out of work because of the government. Now, if this was a market-created problem, then sure, Gavin, we should say, you know, let people, you know, suffer because, you know, companies are suffering and they're out of work and they made poor decisions and they don't have savings, whatever, and we can't save people. There's a moral hazard. Fine. But this crisis is created by government itself. So to not give people the money that is their money to begin with is ridiculous. And then to turn around and fund foreign aid even at all, I mean, why would we fund foreign aid at all right now, when the entire globe is falling apart and our country can't afford anything? Why would we prioritize anyone over an American, period? Right. Why would we prioritize, you know, purchasing of arms for our military? Why wouldn't we do just normal defense spending? Why would we increase defense spending? Why would we do anything in an emergency? Because they can always, of course, say, hey, we need to reinvest in R&D 3 months down the line. It's not like they're going to lose that much. I mean, let's be real clear. We can't do these things, but we can sit there and we can pass these multi-trillion dollar combined spending because that's where the party is and that's where right. These senators are. So if first time Trump supporters are sitting out this election, which it looks like they are. I mean, our results.
It looks like we're about to lose. It looks like we're about to lose. I mean, the numbers are not good. They're not getting better. And, you know, these are wider margins than when Trump ran. So I think it will help what you were saying earlier, that it'll show that Trump is really the future of the party. And if the establishment thinks that, you know, with him off the ticket or with him out of the picture, they're going to fare better, they're sadly mistaken. I mean, this is McConnell. This is McConnell's fault, what I'm looking at right now. And I'm looking at a thrashing, an absolute destruction. I mean, maybe it'll tighten. I don't know. I'm not an expert again in Georgian, you know, political maps and data, but, you know, I don't know how they're going to make up this 10-point gap.
The strong Republican vote turnout occurs in metropolitan Atlanta, specifically the northern suburbs, and the remainder of Georgia. And so far, you know, the rural counties in Georgia are slow to report. That's pretty the norm. So those numbers will go up, but if there is not record election day turnout for Republicans in northern Atlanta suburbs, both senators will go down tonight because these numbers would otherwise be insurmountable. Yeah. As they currently stand.
42% in, they're both races are double digit leads for the Dems. I mean, this is incredible. I mean, this is absolutely incredible. This is Georgia. This is not Michigan. This is not New Jersey. This is Georgia. So, I mean, you know, if they get, and look, if we go back to what we said earlier, the implications of them winning, I mean, if they take United Government, I mean, people like me and you, Republicans, you know, anyone who doesn't, you know, support, the Democrat, you know, establishment and the left wing of their party's views, I mean, we're going to have a rough 2-4 years under this, because they're going to revolutionize, they're going to change the country. They've said as much. They have a track record of doing as much. When Obama had unified government, he didn't miss a beat to radically change what the country was. And I think we're entering a dark place in our country. I mean, yes, I think there were some trends in 2020 that were positive, especially down ballot in the state legislatures in terms of gains made by Trump. And I also think, you know, Biden's coalition was very wobbly. I think it was a coalition that was sort of built around just more being anti-Trump than actually being, you know, proactively for anything. I also think it was added. Its numbers were, you know, inflated due to fears of COVID and elderly whites and things like that, all of which will not exist in 2 or 4 years. So those are silver linings, so to speak. But at the same time, the Dems are going to use whatever momentary control they have to solidify power, like you talked about at a personal level with Clinton versus Schultz in Brazil. And they're going to make sure that whatever gains they make are solidified, codified, and are going to be, you know, impossible to reverse going forward. And we've seen that with, you know, places again, like California, which hasn't flipped since it originally flipped. So doesn't look good. I mean, unless I'm just being pessimistic. I mean, give me some positives here if you can.
Look, I think there's reason to be pessimistic, but at the same time, the Republican Party needs to do what it didn't do in 2008. The Republican Party, its activists, its pundit class, people like you and I need to say the party needs to embrace a winning message. We cannot keep resting on the laurels of, you know, a reincarnated Reaganism. That isn't going to work. Yep. In a globalized, balkanized United States. It's just not. What is going to work is an appeal towards people who care about this country, people who are concerned about, you know, bread and butter politics, people who are less concerned about what's going on around the world, and people who want to ensure that our companies are loyal to our country. And that our politicians aren't profligate with their spending. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And those people are not exclusively white. Those people can be of any race, and they can be of any gender. And I think that is the number one thing that is unspoken about what Donald Trump has done for the Republican Party is expanded it beyond a certain class of people. And the sooner the rest of the party catches up, the better chance we have of undermining the left's full tilt towards socialism. Because the only way they can be socialistic is if they manage to get the working class to support them. There's no such thing as top-down socialism. In what country have they ever gotten the critical mass to make that work? France? I mean, that's the most... not even, because they still rely on the working class.
And they were still a country that, you know, up until recently, you know, was pretty homogeneous. They weren't this necessarily so divided, you know, along racial lines, et cetera. I mean, that's obviously changed. And we're seeing a collapse of France and a collapse of, you know, the Scandinavian utopian socialist countries, or so they're called. So, I mean, even that vision is. And then, of course, in many cases, they were small countries. They weren't even large countries. They didn't have even a geographic component, let alone a racial component to it. But I also want to ask you about what you think, you used to work on the Hill. What do you think about what's going to go down tomorrow in Congress? You think it's going to be a lot of theater, pumping out their chests, you know, parliamentary procedure and you know, talking the good fight, but it ends up going nowhere. And, you know, it just goes down in history as another just failed attempt to fight back against what I believe was legitimate fraud in this election.
Well, let's be clear. Every single person that is participating tomorrow, we can expect is a 2024 candidate
at the Senate, at the Senate level.
In the Senate, and even Vice President Pence. Okay, everything is theatrics. This is not for anyone but Trump supporters who truly believe that the president won and that it was stolen. Every and all theater you see tomorrow will be for the purpose of making sure that Donald Trump feels that they were sufficiently loyal so that they can get out of and make sure that they are not victims of his ire, and so that they can claim the mantle of Trump supporters. there is zero chance that any of them will fight to the death tomorrow to do what they need to do to ensure that the fraud is exposed. There's zero chance. So I want everyone to just understand what politicians are going to do. Politicians are going to politician. Tomorrow is all about making sure that the optics of them opposing the Electoral College are magnified, but it's going to literally do nothing. And, you know, the sad thing is not only is it theater, but it's theater to deceive supporters. And, you know, I think.
So you think it's cynical?
I am cynical, and it is a cynical ploy by every single one of them. And, you know,
what about the comparisons to 1876 and all this?
Someone like, Senator Martha from Tennessee.
Blackburn.
Thank you. Marsha Blackburn, yeah. Are we really going to believe that she's a Trumpist? She's never demonstrated that she was. Okay? Are we really going to believe that she is going to fight to the death? Is that really what's going on? Do we really believe that? Her record doesn't show that. It doesn't show that at all. I mean, she was a conservative, sure. But is she a Trumpian? No. So, you know, I mean, we really have to examine the motivations here. And at the end of the day, this is all about making sure that Donald Trump doesn't lambast any single one of them. And they won his support. So I'm looking at every single one of them. I'm going to see who puts up the biggest fight, because it has nothing to do with 2020 and has everything to do with 2024. And I think Trump supporters out there should understand and look at that with a critical eye, because unfortunately,
Don't you think he would run in 2024? I mean, what do you think the field's going to look like?
Look, I mean, he may want to run, but, you know, he could be in ill health. He could slip a disc. He could end up getting arrested, assassinated. You know, like there are many, many things that could happen between now and then. And we all know what happens with the best laid plans, right? You know?
Right.
So anyone, and all politicians are snakes, right? So they're going to lay in the grass and they're going to lay the groundwork. And pounce when they're ready to pounce. So I think all Trump supporters should look tomorrow with a critical eye, because the problem is, what I was going to say is that Donald Trump won't. The one weakness that Donald Trump really truly has is flattery. If these people sufficiently flatter him and sufficiently ingratiate themselves, even if they are utter pieces of shit, he will put his arm around them and praise them, and his supporters will do the same. Yep. And, you know, I have to say, one of his most loyal, pieces of shit was Lindsey Graham, right? And to this day, still, you know, very loyal to the president, but is always about Lindsey Graham. And, you know, the Trump supporters came out. But the difference is that Lindsey Graham was in office at the same time Donald Trump was. So, you know, this is different now, because now that Trump's about to be out of office, the only concern these people have in making sure that Donald Trump likes them and doesn't run against them or doesn't do broadsides against them, right? They don't want to be the next Marco Rubio.
Who do you think is the strongest in this field outside of Trump? What do you think of a DeSantis? I know you've been in Florida on and off. You threw out sometime after you left Florida. So what do you think of Mr. DeSantis? He seems I personally like him. I think he's a great candidate. I think he's a great governor. He seems to have, you know, the right charisma. He seems to have the right fight in him. He can, you know, he handles the press sometimes even better than Trump does in many respects. He seems very effective, and he's capable in governing an executive role. He's experienced in a legislative role. He seems like he checks a lot of boxes. What do you think of him?
I think DeSantis is a very, very, very credible candidate. And, you know, I know you talk a lot about him. Not many people do. Not many people do, because he's gotten a lot of criticism within Florida. And so, you know, the national media outside of Florida obviously doesn't like him and has lambasted him. But what they don't see and what they don't know, of course, is that his support has not eroded in Florida. I mean, he was at one point the most popular Republican governor next to Charlie Baker and the gentleman from Maryland. Who I know you love. But, you know, real legitimate Republican was the most popular. And then it, of course, it eroded due to COVID, like almost every approval rating of every governor, and that's fine. But he is overwhelmingly approved by Floridians, and the media class in general likes to ignore him. But he's not alone. I mean, I think he could be, for all the reasons that you said, he could run and win. What I do think, though, is the Republican Party, in my mind, should double down on what it is that the left does. And frankly, it is embrace identitarianism to its maximal conclusion. And that is something like some fusion ticket between, a Kristi Noem and a governor who I know you hate, Nikki Haley, where they go woman, woman. And then what do the Democrats have to do? They go working class woman, which is, Kristi Noem, and immigrant woman. I mean, like, it'll make Democrats lose their mind. I'm not saying they should. But the more Republicans begin to fight the way Democrats have fought, the better chance we are at winning. Because every argument they have, we can start just blowing up. And that's what Donald Trump did. Even as a white man who was a billionaire, he blew up the argument that only politicians could be elected. Boom. That's gone. He blew up the argument that white men could appeal to black people. Boom. That's gone. He blew up the argument that a white man could appeal without speaking Spanish at all, or even trying or pandering. Hello, Beto O'Rourke. Hispanics. Boom. Right. Okay. Now, yeah, so he lost white women. Great. But guess what? He did better with minority women. Ironic, right? So again, conventional wisdom is just that. It's conventional. It doesn't mean it's wisdom. That's where we get it wrong, right? Conventional wisdom is conventional, but it's not necessarily wisdom. So, I think the party has a lot of opportunities. Should we choose people who are boring? I don't think so. One thing Donald Trump taught us is that Reagan had the right mix of things, right? That someone who understood the power of media was an unstoppable Republican.
Right.
And other than the Teddy Roosevelts of the world, the Eisenhowers of the world, because people forget Eisenhower was adept at media. I mean, he was loved. Now, was he a liberal Republican? Sure. But he was loved because he wasn't afraid of the camera.
I would say moderate Republican.
You know, the next one that you had that had pizzazz
was Reagan.
Was Reagan.
Yeah.
And then Trump. Okay. So we got to make sure that, as much as I love someone like, Josh Hawley,
Josh Haley, Nikki Haley's bastard child.
Well, yeah, all these Republicans with their slightly off names,
Says Jaden Horan.
Right. But people get my name wrong. I don't look sideways. It's, I get it.
Well, when the podcast viewers who are now watching, they see your name, they're just going to assume I was, talking to a black guy. But anyway, on that note.
This happens all the time.
Yes. Well, on that note, I want to get, because we're pushing up on the hour here, I want to give you the last words. This has been a great discussion, even though the results are pretty depressing, honestly, and I kind of want to just, go throw some water on my face. But I want to give the last word to you after this great podcast. Definitely want to have you back on again. Please let the Waxcast viewers, audience, and listeners know where they can follow the great Jaden Horan for his future commentary and insights.
You can follow me on Twitter at Jaden Horan, on Instagram at Jaden Horan. You can find me on Facebook, Jaden Horan. It's really easy. I'm the only one, apparently.
And it's Tumblr. I love kitty cats. 1, 2, 3. Yes,
and dogs.
Last word.
I think tonight, Republicans are going to lose. And I think it's because they decide that the party is better off burned down than saved. And, my projection is based on what things are coming in is, we're going to find probably around 51, 49. And that's going to be the final result.
Sad times, but maybe it's for the better. We'll have to see. But stay tuned as we examine all that and much more on the Waxcast. And do not forget to leave us a nice, fat 5-star review on iTunes. That'll help us get found by many others. And stay tuned for more, guys, as we enter into a new period in American history.